English singer-songwriter Pierce Ficini just released Songs of Time Lost with French cellist Vincent Segal this past month. I was able to chat with Pierce about the new record, his thoughts on fandom and the music industry, and his Delta Blues inspirations.
Count down all the promises that don't last. Number of the moments lost of time past. Watch the turn of days and how they go by. Time lives in our words, in our lives. The past is the place we leave behind. Faster than the clouds blowing on the breeze. Lighter than the fall of.
I've been a fan of your music for a while now, and I'm very excited to be talking to you today about your new record.
Oh, fantastic. That's good to know.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the first songs I heard from you that really turned me on to your music was A Storm Is Going to Come. I absolutely love that song. And then I turned into Your Name No More. And then it just kind of escalated to the point where I've been following you on SoundCloud now with your new cover series. And it's just...
Oh, brilliant.
Your voice is just absolutely... amazing, and it's so great. I'm still surprised that you haven't gotten, I don't know, more press or more attraction to it. It's so good.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's nice to that you say that, but who knows? You know, I think, you know, my music is also very, although there are certain songs like the ones you mentioned that obviously are a bit more dynamic and more kind of rhythm, and there's a lot of very quiet stuff. And you know, quiet music, often I find it's like, you know, it's like if you're having an intimate conversation with someone, if you're not shouting, some people just don't seem to hear you because they only pick up on people who shout or who raise their voice. But if you speak quietly, you know, and are not in a hurry and just measure their words, sometimes those things slip underneath the radar. So maybe that's what it is.
Well, it's probably that, and also I feel like there's some sort of maybe a European sensibility about less of a gimmick and more about truth-telling through music. And I think in America, maybe that's not like the in thing, the mainstream thing. You know, it's not going to compare to, you know, Bon Iver, who has these connections to like Kanye West, who's a trailblazer and so crazy, or, you know, the Katy Perrys of the world.
Yeah, I think that's true. I do think that's true. I think that I've been quite kind of hardcore about never sort of allowing any kind of, for me, it's just all about the songs. It's all about the music. And I've always felt like I don't really want to have to be able to spin a story about people I'm hanging out with, or that I'm hip, or I'm this or that, or I'm mates with such and such, in order to get people to listen to my music. And I think that, you know, that to a certain extent, there are a lot of media outlets do kind of function on that way, because they just like they'll just recycle those stories which are the ones that are picking up speed, you know, and rolling, and the other stuff, well, it just carries, you know, it'll carry on doing its own thing, but it will get less mileage. But, you know, on the other hand, I do feel like, you know, I'm now, you know, I've made 6 records, and I've been around for a while, and, you know, I'm just quietly doing my thing, and I get to play all over the world, not in front of huge audiences, but in front of a decent crowds wherever I go. And I have, you know, people who really love my music, and that's okay. That's already great for me, you know.
Well, I guess it's the difference between maybe long-term fans that are going to be passionate about your music, and then short-term fans who
exactly.
are really in it just for the buzz and being part of this larger group of people to feel belonged.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you take, for example, the song A Storm Is Going to Come that you mentioned, you know, that's a song that obviously gathered a lot of people heard that song because of the connection with Grey's Anatomy, and also the way in which it was used on that show. And so it was very dramatic. It was like the last episode of the series and blah, blah, blah. So it was used in a very dramatic way. Like, often, you know, my music has been used before on some TV and film stuff, and sometimes it's kind of there in the background. That one was foreground. It was really like it was used in a very dramatic way. So, but what was interesting about that was, although that's the song that is sort of in one go, gathered a lot of, you know, interest, you know, one has to consider that if you look at my kind of loyal fan base, the long-term fan base, which is what the one you're talking about there, you know, most of those people are not necessarily people who will have discovered me through that one song. Because, what you know, a lot of people who heard that one song, they loved that one song, but they didn't necessarily go any further.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them did, of course, and then they become the long-term fan. But I think when you know, that there is a big difference. And I think that for a long-term career, and if you're, you know, I'm in love with songwriting. I'm just very passionate about just a simple exercise of how to put words to music and try and, you know, making albums. And as long as I have enough people who are willing to pick up on what I do, and, you know, then I can carry on doing it. So, you know.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't know it was part of Grey's Anatomy. I'll be honest, I hate Grey's Anatomy. I think it's a bit of soap opera, you know, stuff. But I found it actually through a mixtape a friend gave me. And
okay, cool.
Yeah, which I think maybe that's...
Well, that probably explains why you went on to discover more music and you didn't stop there, because maybe if you'd been a Grey's Anatomy fan, you would have just been like, oh, that's a cool song, and then that's it. You
know? Yeah. No, it's totally true. I mean, that happens too. I was going to ask you this later on, but I think it's great to have music part of a TV show or a major movie franchise, and I'm sure artists can agree to that. It gets them a lot more exposure, gives them more money for future records to do what they want. But I don't know. It's not exactly selling out, but it's doing something that's different to the music. It's not exactly organic.
I think that, you know, the music in the industry has changed so much over the last, like, say, 10 years. And obviously, you know, one of the major game changers has been the fact that people don't buy physical objects, or very few people buy physical objects. So basically what happened is suddenly, of course, publishing remains the same. You know, the revenue from publishing and from exposure of, you know, via media outlets, that's where the money is, and it's continued. So suddenly, you know, a musician who's still out there gigging but isn't hardly making any money on record sales, suddenly the fact that they're on a TV show can have a big impact, you know. And I think that's why all bands and all people are so desperate to get on these things. But I personally believe that they're a bit of a poison chalice. Like, I've never done any ads or anything like that. So I think that, you know, I think if you have your... I'm not a Grey's Anatomy fan either. I kind of watched from a distance, and I thought it was kind of curious to see how people discovered it, and there was a kind of little phenomenon around that song. But I also was very interesting to see how little time it lasted, really, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of confirmed what I think, which is that ultimately, you know, the people that I'm really interested in conversing with, in a way, and having that conversation with, the people who will go beyond just listening to one song that just happens to be on a show that they like, you know what I mean? But I think what's problematic, and I think it's a big decision, and I've never had to make that, actually, probably thankfully, is if, you know, you have some big kind of company, a worldwide company, decides they want to use your music on an ad. Because then, of course, you're getting a huge amount of exposure, but then you can never untie the tag.
Mm-hmm.
So suddenly a beautiful song, hopefully, if it's a beautiful song, will always be associated with, you know, a phone, or, I don't know, a kind of shampoo, or, you know, kind of, who knows, whatever it is. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think that musicians have to be very careful about that.
Well, if you were to do that, if a big company were to come up to you and say, Pierce, we want to use your song in this, and it's going to be a full, you know, year-long campaign, what's a product that you'd be more likely to give your song over to? Or is there a product or brand in particular you use yourself and you'd be okay with?
You know, honestly, like, just to give you an idea of how this, I've never, you know, this has never happened to me. And because it's never happened to me, I've actually never really given it any serious thought, you know. You know, the one thing that I have done recently, which was for a campaign in France, But just I agreed to do it because I thought it was a really cool campaign and I liked the way the film was done. It hasn't actually been released yet, but it was actually an institutional campaign made by the French, part of the French kind of, I guess, government. And it was basically to encourage men and women to feel that all professions and all walks of life were available to both sexes.
Aww.
So, you know, it was kind of a cool campaign. There was, like, you know, shots of, you know, men. The idea was, like, a man could be, like, a midwife, or a man could be, like, looking after young kids, and a woman could be a builder or a butcher or, you know. So it was kind of like it was a cool little film. And so, of course, that was easy for me to do because I thought it was a great project, you know.
That is so cute. And that's, I guess that's just a testament to the way European media is. Like, that's, I'm sure that, like, a campaign like that or video is just so natural to see. And in America, it's taken however many years to maybe put on a 30-second spot that probably doesn't have that same emotion or that same satisfaction. That is so great. I didn't expect an answer like that from you. I expected, like some sort of body spray or, I don't know, like a can of soda or pop or something, but that's really admirable.
I tend to be sort of quite alternative in the kind of a little bit like the music, really, in the way of, like, you know, I wrote on my website, there's a post that I did called Why Music Is Food, and I wrote a lot about the value of music and the true value of music, and equated it to food, basically, and how not only when you buy food, you use it to nourish yourself, to feed yourself, but you also don't buy it free. You don't go to a market store, pick up some apples, and walk away without paying the person. But then it goes beyond that. I also use the analogy to say, if you are going to spend money on food, why not spend it and give it to people who treat the earth with, you know, respect, who use, you know, who decide to make life more difficult for themselves by not using pesticides, by not using fertilizers, by going organic, by having, you know, all of those things. And so I equated that with music and with the importance today that the true music fan has, because the true music fan, if he does go onto an artist's website and buy directly, he can have a huge impact, because if enough people do that, then that artist, it helps to give him a certain independence to carry on making the music he wants to do without feeling that he has to go and accept when Coca-Cola comes knocking on the door saying, we want to use your song for an ad, you know.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you too. You're basically a born and raised European artist. I mean, I know you've had connections to American record companies with your past records, but I mean, pretty much you've been able to move away from, like, the Hollywood or the American music scene and do your own thing in Europe. Do you think that that's made a difference with your music, being away from the way America runs its music industry?
I don't know, because I think for me, like, my experience of America is very, you know, I can see that the sort of mainstream, you know, music business and media that you're talking about, but I've always kind of, you know, I've always been lucky because I've worked with two American labels who've put out my music since 2005. The first one was Everloving Records, who were based in Los Feliz in L.A., and the second one is Six Degrees, who have put them out, and they're both, you know, indie record companies, who I think go against the grain. They put out music that's not necessarily easy commercial music. They have, you know, and in very different ways, they both do great work. And for me, coming from that, you know, what we could loosely call what you talk about as being more European sensibility, you know, I found myself very much at home with those people. So, but I think that's an example of a kind of minority. But I think there are also loads of this, you know, a great independent scene in you know, in North America. And so
I think you're right. There's a certain kind of freedom that comes from it. But I think that's why it's such a great interesting place to be. There's so many things going on, but they all have this like wonderful, sometimes organic sense to them. And then, of course, when like a top 40 station comes along and says, "Well, you'll be our indie alternative pick of the week," then they're kind of plucked from obscurity and they become kind of like with you with the Grey's Anatomy thing. So
yeah.
But I love the potential of indie alternative. It can go from anywhere like crazy, like Arcade Fire, Rah Rah Riot, to, you know, maybe something slowed down, kind of like with your music. It can be just kind of you and a guitar and your voice and just doing these beautiful melodies and stories.
I'm really firm believer. I think, you know, the beauty of music, it's like reading a book. Is basically, of course, you can read a book to a group of people, but most people who read books, it touches them in that moment individually. And even if you're in a group of 100 people in a room listening to one song, just because the guy next door to you is touched by it doesn't mean you will be. Everyone hears it or doesn't hear it individually, and it's that connection that songs have with the individual, where it just like connects something up or it doesn't, and when it connects up, it links the song to that person's life. And that's why also people kind of get, certain people almost too much, get kind of crazy about the how much they love your music, because they feel like you've written a song about their life.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, that's the beauty of it. The beauty of it is that that's what songs do. Like you hear it individually, and when it touches you because you recognize it. Because something in that song, there's a recognition that ties back to your own experience. And ultimately, it's a numbers thing. Of course, we all need to have a certain amount. We need to have a certain number of people who are connecting up those, you know, those wires to our music in order to make a living out of it. But if we can make a living out of it, you know, if it's a few more here or a few less here, it's not really a numbers game for me. After a while, it's a qualitative thing rather than a quantitative thing. You know?
Shake your hands, jump your feet. Tip your head and feel the beat. Shake your hands, jump your feet. Tip your head and feel the beat. Yellow, red, black and brown. In every mask a soul is found.
So even though Songs of Time Lost just came out, for the last year, you released 2 volumes of cover songs. And
yeah.
I mean, you released them on SoundCloud. People could download them. You only requested that they give you their email address so you can keep them up to date with your music. But it's that kind of like freedom in music and providing music and giving others that love. That's just, it's really great. And your covers are great too. I mean, it's not like you're giving away bad music. You're giving away amazing different interpretations of classic songs.
And again, you see, that was just a way. Because traditionally, you know, an artist will release an album, you know, every 2 years on average, if they're prolific. And so, you know, a lot of the time, like, you'll release the album, so you record it, and you release it, and then you go out on the road. But some people are more prolific than others, and some people are perhaps more passionate than others or whatever. But I just felt like I had so much energy and so much desire to just keep making music, and one of the things I really wanted to share with that project is just to underline the fact that nothing comes from nowhere. Like, whatever you do, whatever you hear that's amazing, done by people that you like, that always ties back somewhere else. We're only ever recycling, reinventing the things that we love. And so every artist who's ever lived, however much of a genius they are, whether they're a poet, a writer, a musician, is always indebted to their own individual heritage of people who have influenced them. And so for me, the Songs I Love thing was just a way of having a dialogue and saying, like, we're all just music fans. Like, we're all just touched by songs in particular ways. And the way in which we're touched by songs creates stories of their own. And that's why I made the book. And in the book, I told the story behind each song. And I also drew a picture of each artist that I was covering. And it was just really to kind of just have an exchange about the passion that all music fans have for music. It was very kind of heartfelt and naive. There was nothing more than that behind it, you know. And I'm still carrying on. Like, as you say, the volume 2 is going on. I give them away, and then when I've got a certain amount, then I put together an object. And funny enough, all the people who've already downloaded them will actually, well, not all of them, but many of them will actually read, they'll buy the object because they know that with my label, Beating Drum, I'll put out a really beautiful object.
Mm-hmm. Now, of the songs that you have covered, I've played State Trooper on a couple shows back, which I liked. Which has been your favorite to play or to cover?
I think probably the artist who I think probably strangely has most influenced me is probably Skip James. And so I sung on the cover series, I songs I love, I cover a song of his called Cypress Grove Blues. And I just, this, when I first heard Skip James many, many years ago, when I was about 18, 19, I was a fan of the Smiths and more had more of an indie kind of English indie rock kind of background. And I heard by chance a recording of Skip James singing the song on an acoustic guitar, just him by himself. And I just, something just clicked. Something just like happened in me. It was like a thunderbolt or something. And I just suddenly was like, oh my God, like that's the music I want to make. And it wasn't, and the thing is with Skip James, of course he's a blues man, but more than anything for me, Skip James, he's like the most individual of all of those blues men. Like he's was such an incredible lyricist. Like a poet, for me, he's a poet. He played the guitar in a completely individual way. No one played like him. Had this extraordinary voice, and I just feel like he's really one of the great songwriters of all time, you know. And but it was the hearing that there could be such intensity and beauty with so little means, just someone singing to a guitar, I was like, I want to spend my life trying to get close to that kind of intensity and beauty. And, you know, that's sort of been really what I've been doing the last, all these years, you know. So if there was one artist and one from the series that I had to sort of, but it's funny because, you know, I'm good friends with Ben Harper and he heard me play Skip James, and he's like, you're crazy, like no one plays Skip James, it's like, it's so individual, like it's such a difficult thing to play, but I've listened to it so much that, and I love his music so much, so that, yeah, I'd probably pick that one.
Okay, and I guess it makes sense. I mean, he's like a Delta blues master, like you said,
yeah.
And I can hear more of that kind of blues influence in your earlier records, particularly with Two Grains of Sand. But with Songs of Time Lost, I guess because of the collaboration you have with Vincent and with more of a classical vibe, I don't hear that blues as much.
Well, one can hear it in a more subtle way, perhaps. For example, you know, there's one song that we do called Cradle to the Grave, which is almost like a kind of more of a New Orleans kind of inspired kind of riff. It's almost like an Alan Toussaint kind of riff. And it's more songy than a sort of classic kind of blues. I guess for me, the thing is that in my music, I always feel profoundly influenced by different aspects of African music. So that's either directly, you know, for example, music from Mali or from Guinea or Senegal, music from West Africa that's being played today or in the tradition, or otherwise, possibly even more, music done by those of African descent, basically. So that can be the African-American tradition, but it can be it's also the whole Creole, the way in which music was taken from Africa and went to all these different places in the world and just created these own incredible, these unique styles, you know. So again, one example of that on the record is a song that I sing in Creole called Manger pour le Coeur. And that's like, that's a cover as opposed to, we didn't write that. But it's from an island called La Réunion, which is near Madagascar, where people, it's a Creole culture. And so I kind of feel like in my own way, and to a certain extent with my own background, that kind of, I feel very close to that kind of idea of Creoleness in a way.
Huh.
Because of my own, you know, mixed background to a certain extent. From my grandparents came to the UK from very different corners of the world. So I was sort of brought up with many different stories from my grandparents and the country that they came from, and so I kind of feel that mix that you hear in my music of not being able to put it down to one specific place or country is very much linked to my own sort of heritage and upbringing to a certain extent, also being brought up speaking more than one language. And so I think that's the thing that led me also to be sort of feel that recognition when I heard music from around the world. I felt like perhaps certain other people would hear it as being something like it was other or exotic, but for me there was something I recognized, there was a kind of mirroring of some sorts there.
So do you have a preference then in which language you use when you sing or for songwriting?
I would say ultimately the beauty of being able to sing in different languages is that they do different things, and there are things that you can do in English that you can't do in any other languages, and that's fantastic to be able to explore that. So I'm lucky enough to be able to explore that by being able to sing in different languages. But I would say from a writer's point of view, and possibly because I am ultimately British in a way, culturally speaking, to a certain extent, then ultimately my mother language is English. So I do feel that it's the language, although I have written in Italian, I have written in French, I mostly 99% of the time write in English, and that's the language that I prefer to write in. So, and I think English is a fantastic language, you know, when it's sung and written by, you know, if it's a, I don't know, Leonard Cohen singing Famous Blue Raincoat, or Skip James singing Hard Time Killing Floor, you know, or Bob Dylan singing Sarah, you know, it's just an extraordinary language, you know.
Yeah.
It's just a wonderful, wonderful language to sing and to write songs in. But I love music from all over the world, so, but for myself, if I had to choose one, I probably would, like everyone else, choose English, actually.
Okay. And I was wondering, because I guess I started with your music when you were singing English, and so listening to your music then in a different language, it still has that same kind of, I mean, you still have that same beautiful quality to your voice. It's just, it's almost like, oh my gosh, he's just a brilliant person for him to be able to make beautiful music in all these languages. So kudos on that, because not a lot of people can do it in English, let alone in like three other dialects.
Yeah. Thank you. I think, you know, I've always written in English, and I started writing a little bit in Italian and French more recently, and it's very much something I do from time to time. And even though I've been able to speak those languages for years, it took me a long time to have the courage to be able to say, actually, I'm going to do it, I'm going to try. And I wrote this song in French on Between Dogs and Wolves that came out last year, and it was the one song. All the rest of the songs were in English, and there was one song in Italian, one song in French. But it went down really well in France. People really liked it. But it was, yeah. Somehow when I write in English, I kind of know whether I've got a good one or a dud, you know. But when I write, I'm slightly less sure if I write in French and Italian. I almost have to show it to someone who's a native speaker to be like, are you sure it works? You know. Whereas in English, I don't have to do that.
Sous chemin, mi wako kon a plein, ki kote zo ti vyan. Partout mi sa va, tout sa mi konpon pa, nan to wati watia, tout wati watia, tout sot wati watia.
So for Songs of Time Lost, when you and Vincent came together for the record, like, how was that process, picking out which songs to play or which ones to, you know, push to the side? Like, how did you decide how to make this record?
basically, it was really easy because we've known each other. We've been such old friends, and we've known each other for so long, and we've discovered so much music together through our friendship that it was kind of. And we've also made records together. You know, he produced and arranged and played on almost every song on my first solo record, Leave No Trace. He also played on Two Grains of Sand. He played on My Wilderness. So I've also done many things with him on various records that he's done. And when we came to make the record, we just, in a way, it sort of just, those decisions just made themselves, because we just naturally thought, if we make a record, we just want to make a record of, that would be like a recording of just how we get together as friends and just sit together and just play music to each other and play music together. And so that's why it is this little mix that it is, that, you know, brings together some very odd things and hopefully makes a coherent result. And but it's really just a soundtrack of our friendship. So we both love, you know, and there are things that we've discovered differently. You know, I think when I met Vincent 25 years ago, I was like massively into Mississippi blues and country blues, and I was already playing Mississippi John Hurt and trying to play Skip James, probably doing it quite badly, but trying anyway. You know, he introduced me to Brazilian music. He introduced me to Alan Pitels, who was the guy we covered in that song that I sing in Creole. So I introduced him a little bit more to music from Naples, because my wife's from Naples, and obviously I'm Italian origin as well. So there's a lot of exchange. So the record was really just, and then we wanted to write songs together as well. So that's why there are also our own songs on it. And we just wanted to make this really like a soundtrack to our friendship and to the things that we loved that we're passionate about. And we wanted to record it in this incredibly simple way. No overdubs, just, you know, we just put the mics there and we did two or three performances of every song over 3 days, and then we just chose the ones we liked, and that was it. We didn't do anything more to it. And then when we play in concert, it's exactly the same thing. That's what's great, you know. Anyone who has the record coming and sees us play in concert, you know, they get a guy playing guitar and a guy playing cello, and that's it, and singing, and that's it. Nothing else, you know. And that's how we made the record. Very simple.
I think there's already a live performance of you all on YouTube, and I was listening to it. Sounded just like the record.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and that's it. The whole record, the whole of our show when we play, is just like that film of those two songs on La Blogothèque is probably the one that you see.
Mm-hmm.
Takeaway shows, yeah. So, yeah, it's great, actually, because very often, you know, when I make my own records under my own name, just my own stuff, I love seeing a studio record and a gig as being two very different things, and I love being able to be quite experimental and to have more instruments and to try make specific, quite elaborate arrangements on the songs. But I know that when I go out on the road, I'll probably just be with one or two other maximum people, so there's always a big difference in a way. But I always, which I like as well, because I think that songs, when they're played live, always benefit from something more immediate, something more stripped down. You know, if it's a good song, it doesn't need to have, you know, 10 musicians playing behind it. It can be sung a cappella and it should still touch people.
Yeah, or auto-tune. You don't need to have auto-tune to have a really good show or, you know, a really good song. You can strip it down and it'll sound just fine.
Exactly.
So I guess last question then, it's kind of a different topic, but a lot of people have described your voice and the way you sing as being from the school of Nick Drake or Leonard Cohen meets Steve Kilby from The Church. Mm-hmm. What do you think about those comparisons?
I think, you know, they're all fantastic artists. So obviously, particularly, you know, Nick Drake and Leonard Cohen, who, I mean, as a lyricist, is the absolute master for me. So any comparison is extremely flattering, and it would be absurd for me to be anything other than flattered by that. I think personally, the Nick Drake thing is a little bit overdone, because I think sometimes they just hear someone who sounds English more or less and sings quietly and finger picks a guitar. And so I think that Nick Drake thing is sometimes a little overdone. And I think I often feel like if people actually listen carefully to it, they'll see that there's a lot, hopefully more to it than just someone who loves Nick Drake. Because, and I think the reason why I say that is because as much as I love the music of Nick Drake, I don't feel like he's never been my number one influence at all, you know. I've always put him in amongst a whole group of British songwriters and guitar players who I've been very influenced by, you know, and if anything, I'm probably possibly more influenced by, you know, John Martin or Martin Carthy or Richard Thompson or David Graham, Bert Jansch, like John Renbourn, like all of that generation was just an extraordinary generation of guitar players and songwriters. So, but, you know, Nick Drake is the one, you know, who died young and beautiful and that everyone knows. So people tend to use that to, but it's ultimately, I feel when they say that, they're really referring back to a kind of school or a movement which produced a lot of extraordinary music, of which Nick Drake is the most well-known example. But that Englishness is there, that kind of folk Englishness is there in my music, even though I marry it often with Mediterranean or African kind of colours.
Make me down a pallet on your floor.
Pierce Piccini just released his collaborative record with Vincent Segal, titled Songs of Time Lost, this past October. To hear more of his music, make sure to listen to A Change of Tune, airing Saturday night at 10 on West Virginia Public Radio. I'm Joni Deutsch. Thanks for listening.
I'm sleeping, my back and shoulders tired.